There are only 31 survivors of the USS Indianapolis tragedy still living here in 2015, and as it turns out, one of them is a Lansing resident. And I wanted to mention that before the hour was through, our Kevin Lavery pays a visit to Dick Thalen. Back in July of 45, Dick Thalen was an 18-year-old sailor on board the Indianapolis, and of course, what happened to the Indianapolis was a colossal tragedy here. It went down in the middle of the Pacific, and of course, sharks attacked the men who ended up being in the water and took many lives on that day, July of 1945. But we visit with Dick Thalen later this hour, along with everything else we have planned for Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. At the top of our program, some Lansing families have been enjoying more financial stability recently. That's partly the result of a program launched 2 years ago that created a financial empowerment center here in the capital city. Only five cities in the country received the grants for the initiative, which came from Bloomberg Philanthropies. The idea was to provide free advice to residents experiencing problems related to credit, saving, debt, and banking. Now, the center's newest program is called Lansing Save. It's designed to help families start saving money for post-secondary education while their children are still very young, specifically those entering kindergarten in the fall. Here to tell us more about Lansing Save is Director Jamie King, and we're also pleased to welcome Jose Cisneros, the treasurer for the City and County of San Francisco. Jose's the founder of a similar savings program there. Jamie King, Jose Cisneros, welcome to Current State.
Hi.
Good morning.
I understand you're from Michigan.
I am. I grew up in Muskegon.
Okay. Well, welcome home.
Thanks.
My first question is actually for you, Jose. You started a program similar to Lansing Save, the program we're starting. In San Francisco. It was called Kindergarten to College. How long ago was that, and what were the goals of the program?
We started that program 5 years ago in San Francisco. We were interested in finding a way to help low-income families get their kids queued up for college and have every possibility of success. There was a study that showed that if a child grows up with a college savings account in the child's name, that child is many times more likely to go to college just because aspirations are built up over a lifetime by seeing that account and understanding college is something I'm supposed to do, mm-hmm. and they went ahead and did it. Mm. We wanted to bring that kind of success to every child in San Francisco, so we started a program that now, the same as here, opens up a college savings account for every child that enters kindergarten automatically, no paperwork, no parent signatures, nothing. Every one of the incoming kindergartners has a college savings account.
Interesting idea. Jamie King, how will Lansing Save mimic kindergarten to college out in California, and how might it differ?
Absolutely. Well, Lansing Save is built from the platform of Kindergarten to College from San Francisco. We also have an automatic and universal program, so all kindergartners enrolled in the Lansing School District are eligible. One of the additional things that we are doing is we are really looking at involving the parents as well in this program through their participation, working through the Office of Financial Empowerment. So not only are we empowering these kindergartners to start thinking about post-secondary educational opportunities as early as 5 and 6 years old, we're really working with the parents to help them along with their future and with their financial needs as well.
And I understand that there will be a few bucks in these accounts that are set up. Where is that coming from?
Absolutely. We have partnered with Michigan State Federal Credit Union, and they have agreed to seed all of the accounts with $5. And that will continue as we continue to roll out the program for all the kindergartners in Lansing. And additionally, my job is to go out and look for philanthropic contributions and donations as well.
Jose Cisneros, can you say Kindergarten to College is a success?
Yeah, I would say it is a success. What we're doing is we're opening up accounts, same as here, for every incoming kindergartner, and we're reaching out, of course, to parents to encourage them to start saving for their kids' college education. Not too many five-year-olds are quite yet going to the bank and making deposits, so it's really about motivating the parents.
How do you measure that success, though?
Well, we're looking at...
track the deposits?
We open up the accounts actually in a custodial account, so the accounts are actually all opened in the name of the City and County of San Francisco with individual accounts, then connected to that account, one account for each child. We therefore have complete access to all the information of the deposits made into the accounts. And so far, we're seeing about 14-15% of all the families have started to save. And what's exciting to us is that those families, in just a few short years, have saved over $1.3 million of their own family money for their kids' college educations. And these are some of the poorest families in our city.
Do you receive assistance, like Lansing is going to receive assistance from MSU, FCU? Do you have a contributor that puts a few bucks in each of these accounts?
We have funds to fund the program, both coming from the city. The city puts a significant amount of money in each year to open up the accounts, administer the program, and put the initial deposits in. And then we've raised private money, philanthropic donations as well. And with that money, we're actually offering incentives, cash incentives to the families to motivate them to save. We tell the families, we've opened up this account for you. We've put an initial deposit in, but now we'd like you to save because that's really the only way your kid's going to have money to pay for college. And we'll match your savings. We actually match their savings dollar for dollar up to the first $100 they put in the account. We offer people a chance to double their money. I think that's pretty good these days.
And the community's behind it. The there is a consensus amongst the residents of San Francisco that this is a good thing.
Amongst the folks that live there, amongst actually the city leaders who put this into the city's budget each year and have continued to do that. And now we're seeing that thousands and thousands of families are starting to save in these accounts, which I think just shows that we're making a difference in the community.
What, if anything, do you say to the 80% or so of those people who are not participating?
Right. We tell them, hurry up and start saving. That's really what we tell them. You know, what we do is we're trying to build awareness. We have 4,500 kids that start kindergarten each year. Mm-hmm. That we need a pretty massive advertising campaign to reach that many families in a short amount of time. But the good news is we have a long on-ramp to get these families to find a way to start saving. So these kids are in kindergarten. They're 5 years old. We got a few years before they're going to need money for college. So we keep working with the families. We get out in front of the parents every chance we get. We're trying to motivate them, send them good messages. And actually, since we partner with this program for the public schools, it's actually school principals, school teachers, PTAs, and school staff that are helping us deliver that message to get more and more families into the program.
Jamie King, do you anticipate having those kinds of conversations and really embarking on a kind of a promotional campaign to get really get as much participation in this thing? I mean, 15%. I mean, you've saved an awful lot of money in San Francisco. It's impressive. It's really a good thing. But by the same token, there's a huge percentage of people who just don't participate. How are you planning to deal with that?
Absolutely. And that's part of our programming as well. We also will be doing the matching and incentive programs for our students just to go ahead and encourage the participation of the parents, because we know that the custodial parent is really who's honing in the message for those students. But we're also very, very lucky to have the partner of Lansing School District, and we have the support of central administration as well as the school principals and teachers as well, helping to really push the message of Lansing Save and looking at post-secondary opportunities as early as kindergarten, asking the students, who do you envision that you want to be when you grow up?
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the new Lansing Save program being started by the Lansing Financial Empowerment Center with Director Jamie King, who you just heard from. We're also joined today by Jose Cisneros, the treasurer for the City and County of San Francisco. He started a similar program there. Jamie, Lansing's Financial Empowerment Center is in the last year of a 3-year pilot program. Is the initial Bloomberg grant money running out?
It will run out as of December. However, we are fully funded for the calendar year of 2016, thanks to the support from the mayor through the general fund, a grant from the city from the community development block grant dollars, the Ingham County Treasurer's Office, Capital Area Community Services, and others.
Okay. Now, the goals outlined for the Lansing Financial Empowerment Center early back in 2013 included in assisting 4,000 people free of charge with problems related to credit, debt, savings, and banking. How many have been served?
We've served 2,269 clients.
Mm. that's quite a bit short of your goal here. How did that happen?
Well, we found that our clients were more engaged and anticipated, and therefore were coming to more sessions. So even though we weren't reaching more numbers, the people that we were reaching were coming back for repeat sessions. So that is the benefit, and that's the lift that we have at this time that we're very proud of.
Where do people get more information about Lansing Save?
Lansing Save, you can reach us through our website at www.lansingmi.gov/LansingSave.
You were both at a gathering in Detroit yesterday, Financial Empowerment Summit. Who attended? What was on their minds, Jose?
Well, this was a gathering put together by a local group called CDAM that's looking at financial empowerment programs across the state of Michigan. And I saw representatives from all over the state that were coming together to hear about these types of financial empowerment programs, both the financial empowerment centers like they've opened here a while ago in Lansing, but more specifically on the children's savings accounts programs that are happening here, and I believe another one in Berry County that's going to be starting soon, and maybe others in other cities across the state. It was exciting to see the energy around finding a way to help kids be more successful in their chance to go to college.
Jamie, does this program, does Lansing Save tie into the Lansing Promise in some way?
It is. We've been talking recently, and what we'd like to think of it is as the trifecta of hope, promise, and save. Hope doesn't start until the sixth grade, and promise is given at time of graduation for that scholarship opportunity. But what the board of directors found was that the conversations needed to be happening earlier with students. So save is kind of that foundational piece that will start those conversations as early as kindergarten, and then will grow with the students as they matriculate through high school.
Our program is really about Michigan, so we don't often get guests from California here in Studio S. Much has been made of California's revenue situation and its debt. Let me put you on the spot for just a second, Jose. As a city and county treasurer, especially, how do you assess the state's financial challenges?
You know, the state of California has had a lot of financial challenges for a long, long time, and there's been a number of reasons for that. I really credit our current governor, who just is now beginning his second term there, who I think is really getting down to the business of putting the state into a better fiscal and financial position
Jerry Brown, correct?
Whatever you might like or not like about Jerry Brown, I think he's doing a great job of continuing to work hard to improve the financial situation for the state. And he's doing it at a time when the economy globally is rebounding and there's actually some funds flowing in. And more of that is paying off debt that maybe shouldn't have been there in the first place and also going into reserves to help us through the next period of difficulty. I think really, you know, anything you'd call good financial times in the state of California might still be a ways off. But the good news is the city of San Francisco is doing really well, and we're doing, in fact, better financially than the state. So we're continuing to keep our books in order while participating with the state to make things better for everybody in the state of California.
Good for you. Glad to hear about it. We want to thank our guests, City and County of San Francisco Treasurer Jose Cisneros, also Jamie King, director of the new Lansing Save program designed to help families in Lansing save money for post-secondary education. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Glad you could join us today. A downtown Lansing icon is celebrating a momentous event in 2015. This year, Kosacek's menswear store celebrates its 150th anniversary in mid-Michigan. Four generations of the Kosacek family have operated the business. Current president David Kosacek has been at the helm since 1997. When Current State's Kevin Lavery walked into David Kosacek's office, David told Kevin that even though his own father, Richard, has been gone 18 years, he still feels like he's borrowing that room. And it's obvious that he enjoys telling his family's story.
My great-grandfather came from Czechoslovakia and immigrated to the United States in or around 1865 and ended up in Eaton Rapids, Michigan, where we started our store.
And how did Henry start out? Did he make his own clothes? Did he get clothes from somewhere else? How did it all begin?
My great-grandfather started as a really a traveling salesman, going door to door. And that's how he started as a small merchant, eventually opening up a set of front doors in downtown Eaton Rapids. Today, it's the home of Pettit Hardware, and Pettit's have been there well over 100 years, but that was where our original store started.
I'm talking now with Matthew McLeod, who is the general manager of Kozacek's. You have a very elaborate book here on the 145th anniversary of the store 5 years ago, and you put this together.
I did, with the help of Kim Kaufman, who does all of our marketing for us. And so she's the photographer, so I supplied her with the information and the photographs, and she and I compiled the book. And we're working on a second edition that'll come out in October for our 150th. With some new pictures, and we didn't touch on the family a lot in this book, but in the next book we will.
Matthew, how does Kozacek's keep up with fashion trends over the years? Have there been milestones in fashion, in the history of Kozacek's, that have been pivotal times?
Well, I think from the little bit of research that I did on, say, the early, like the turn of the century or the roaring 20s, there was a lot of color and there was a lot of style, but then and with the onset of the Depression, everything got a little drab. Fabric was a little harder to get, so things were, fashions changed a little bit. They went from a lot of color to a lot of monotone, browns and olive and that sort of thing. But I think a lot of history dictates a lot of what happens in fashion. You know, during World War II, that was another thing. There was a lot of rationing, so things got shorter, coats got shorter. People were wearing shorter trousers. You know, things didn't have as many buckles and buttons and things. So there was a definite influence by what's going on in the world, I think.
So there's been a pendulum then of practicality and vanity, and it swings back and forth depending upon the economy.
And the people and people's mood, you know. And I think that's one thing that the Kozacek's has always done, is they've always been, I don't want to say progressive, but they've always anticipated maybe, and they've always been able to change with this change in times. So they've been able to adapt accordingly to the environment that we're, you know, thrust upon.
I'll come back to David here. David, were there key moments in these 150 years where there was a sea change in the industry that made Kozacek's grow or adapt or evolve in some way?
I think there probably were. I started in the late 60s is when I really became involved on a selling basis at our store. And back then, it was Swedish knit suits, and polyester was important factor in for many of the manufacturers at that time. I watched the prices evolve and change, and with that, the fabrics and the just the whole industry has changed, in that we're doing business now today in 2015 with some of the best manufacturers in the world, many of them from Italy, some from Canada. So that's reflective of what's happened in our industry.
Well, do you still have some older customers who have been here for quite some time and they remember that brand and they come to Kozacek's for that, and how have they had to adapt to what you're selling now?
I think most people would like to buy Made in America. That being said, I think the majority of people understand that if it isn't being made, it's not available.
We're talking with David Kozacek, the president of Kozacek's in Lansing, also with Matthew McLeod, who's the general manager of the store. Matthew, let's go back to the book a little bit here. Can you show me some pictures of what Kozacek's fashion has looked like over the years?
Sure. Let's see if we can. Well, this is one of the oldest photos that we have of the store. This was taken in 1869, and this is 210 South Washington. At the time, Kozacek's had two locations, this location and then 200 blocks south. This was the millinery store. You can see by the picture that all the fabrics and then here the clothing and dry goods were sold.
And we're looking at three gentlemen in the picture, and it's very much post-Civil War. I can see Abraham Lincoln wearing something very similar.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I'm not sure of their identities, but so here you get into, this is the current store we're in right now, so you can see merchandising was a lot different than it is today.
It had more of a warehouse shelf stacked look.
Yep, exactly. A lot of bland color, and you know, not nearly as visual as we wear today. But
so layout and design and flow was really secondary in the old days to functionality.
Yeah, and as you can see, the stores were long, narrow, and long. So there really wasn't a pattern. You know, you could go one way; that would be straight back and forward, so everything had to be laid out very easily.
What you see here, Kevin, is a tube system here, and the salesman would take the money from the customers, and then it would go up to the office upstairs, and that's how the transactions were made.
Just sucked it right up then.
Yeah, you see, you don't see a cash register. Yeah. It's done up off the floor. So,
who do you see as your competition?
I would say that any set of front doors is competition, whether it's a more opening and moderate price to a high price, whether they're in Lansing or whether they're in Chicago or Grand Rapids or Detroit, they're all competition. So you, and being in business as long as we have, you always have to envision competition right next door to you. You want to be different. You need to set yourself apart. And we do that with our service. We do it with just the culture that we've created here.
And I'm looking over here at the jewelry counter. That's a fairly recent addition, so an evolution of product line.
We're always changing. We're always thinking about what our customers might enjoy seeing when they come to our store. So the jewelry department joined us 7 years ago, and it's been a great partnership with Leon G. Jewelers. We have a shoe department, we have a hair salon. So all those things make for they have synergy and make for a wonderful, harmonious retail shopping experience.
How are you celebrating your 150th? You published a book a few years ago. Anything similar, any similar plans this year?
Coming this fall, we are putting together and we'll re-release a 150th historical book about our company, about our anniversary, and we plan on having a few private events and a few public events, but ringing a quiet bell, marking our 150th year serving Lansing and Michigan.
For any business to survive 150 years is impressive. What has been the constant that has kept the thread going, so to speak?
Do you know, it has to, it's guesswork on my part. You know, looking back, I'm 62 years young, or 62 years old, and I can only surmise in that it really was the people that this company was lucky enough to have, even back then. Even 150 years ago, we had wonderful people that were working with us. And I think therein lies the difference for a family business that has been able to span four generations. People don't work for us. They work with us. And we row the boat together. And that has been the motto that we have always had. That was true. I was lucky enough to work with my grandfather, Lewis, and I worked with my father, Richard. And it was an honor and a pleasure. We often sit and say that my dad could walk back in, or my grandpa, and nothing has changed. It really hasn't. The culture is still the same.
David Kozacek, president and owner of Kozacek's in Lansing, and also Matthew McLeod, general manager. Congratulations on your 150th birthday. David, great talking with you.
Thank you, Kevin. It was a pleasure to visit with you today.
Matthew, a pleasure.
Thank you, Kevin. Appreciate it.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, we hear from the first woman ever to win an Olympic gold medal for boxing. Current State's Melissa Benmark talks to Flint's Clarissa Shields about her incredible career and the new documentary that profiles the boxer's life. Plus, in the waning days of World War II, a Japanese submarine sunk the USS Indianapolis. The boat had just delivered parts of the first atomic bomb. The sailors who survived spent 4 days in the Pacific facing sharks, dehydration, and exposure. Current State's Kevin Lavery talks to one of the 300 men who survived those difficult days at sea. That and more after this break. Three times every weekday on WKAR, it's Current State, 9 and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM and every day at noon on AM 870 WKAR. Right now we want to share with you an audio snapshot from Current State's new Hear Hear project. That's H-E-A-R-H-E-R-E. Current State listener Deb bought her husband Joe a ride-along in a NASCAR vehicle at the Michigan International Speedway for his 68th birthday, and she was kind enough to bring our ears along for the ride. And away we go. Current State needs your ears to help us make this project happen. Submitting your own audio snapshot to Hear Here is easy. Please use the Voice Memo app on your smartphone to record about a minute of sound. Maybe you want to share the roar of the crowd at a Lugnuts game or the sound of your paddles as you kayak down the Red Cedar River. There's all kinds of possibilities. Once you're happy with your sound, you can email the file along with your name and a description of the sound and the approximate location where you recorded it to currentstate@wkar.org. You can hear more sounds from around the state by searching for Hear Here on wkar.org. Hundreds of people gathered at the Flint Institute of Arts last night to see a film about Clarissa Shields. She's the gold medal boxer from Flint, and WKAR's Melissa Benmark has more. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. Earlier this week, we heard from Sue J. Johnson, who's the producer of T-Rex, which is the documentary about Clarissa Shields' journey to the 2012 Olympics and back. The movie is making the rounds of various film festivals, including Traverse City last weekend, but Shields really, really wanted to be sure it was shown in her hometown last night it was. And earlier this week, I got to speak to her about the film, the Flint screening, and what's next for her. And I started by asking her where the nickname T-Rex came from.
T-Rex came from one of my sparring partners when I was younger. And I didn't have a boxing nickname, you know, but I was the best in the gym. And he asked me, and I said, I don't know. And he came up with a few different names. He used Reese Cup as one. I told him, no, that's a stripper's name. And then he used Chakra Thunder. I'm like, dude, what is wrong with you? No, it's not a name. And then he said T-Rex. And I said, why T-Rex? He said, because you're mad aggressive and your arms are short.
No kidding. That's, do people, you know, when you go to these films and these screenings, do people call you that when they see you?
T-Rex, yeah. A lot of people call me T-Rex, and because they don't know, you know, that's the name of the documentary. But it's fine. I know who they're talking to and what they're talking about, so it's fine. I like the name T-Rex. It's cool.
Are you touring with the film right now?
I don't go to all the film screenings, but I do come to the ones that's like really important. They like work around my boxing schedule, and we come to the ones that I can come to. And I do a questionnaire after the documentary is over.
How does it feel to see it and to see people reacting to it?
Well, the first time I seen it, I was very pleased, and I was excited for my family and friends to see it. And I really want everybody to see it. I mean, I would love to get Whoopi Goldberg to see it and, you know, Oprah, because it's a great story, and they put it together very well. And that was the best that I've ever seen. You know, my story told. I've done over 1,000 interviews and spoke to over 1,000 journalists. And they always, you know, mix my words up and stuff like that. But the documentary is me in the documentary, and it's saying exactly what I said, and I show how I felt. And they piece it together so well that is my story. You know, and it wasn't any confusion. It's far, far, far from. I was really expecting it. I mean, let's say I expected less because I was like, people have told me about my story so many times. I'm like, they just don't get it right. But after talking to Sue and Zach and, you know, and everything and Dre, it came out and it was great. I loved every minute of it. I could watch it over and over again, really.
That's really unusual because so many people say when they see something made out of their life story, well, you know, didn't quite get it right.
No, they got it right. The only thing I wish is that I wish I would have talked a lot slower. I talk so fast. I was like, speak slower, but I used to be so amped up all the time, and speaking about how I feel is like I just blah, 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 blah.
So I understand you were just in the Pan Am Games in Toronto, and how was that?
Oh, Toronto turned out great. I love the Pan Am. It was like a mini Olympics. Of course, I won there. I boxed 3 times. It was fun. It was fun. We had a great team. We had a great training camp. And a lot of us medaled, so it was great. I got a gold medal, of course, but other people medaled too.
How do you feel like you've matured in the ring since the 2012 Olympics?
Oh, 2012 Olympics? I think about now, if I was to go against the old Clarissa Shields, like 17, I would definitely beat her. And I'm actually proud to say that because I was so good back then. Now, I feel like I'm unbeatable. I'm a little taller now. I'm definitely a lot stronger than what I was. And I'm just smarter now. I used to have a problem with fighting taller opponents. Now it's simple. I can beat anybody. I don't have any problems with no kind of fighter. I won the world championship. Just won the Pan Ams and everything. I'm just a lot more mature, and I know how to train harder and train past my limits. And I think when I was 17, I was being led to do that. Now I'm leading myself, and I've definitely changed. I mean, I think I'm a lot smarter, and like I said, I'm faster and stronger and stuff like that. So
we're talking with boxer Clarissa Shields from Flint, the first woman ever to win a gold medal for middleweight boxing, or I believe for that matter, any kind of boxing. What was it like after being at that height with the Olympics to come back to Michigan? How would you describe that period after you came back?
After I came back from the Olympics, I think I was actually a little scared. Actually, I'm not scared to meet new people, but I know that some people come into your life and they don't have your best interest. I was just like, you know, I don't want to have those people in my life. I just want to deal with the same people I've been dealing with, continue to box, continue to win, and make some money. That was it, you know. Didn't be able to take care of my family. But after I got back, I was getting over 40 phone calls a day, over 100 text messages, people I did know, people I didn't know. And it was scary because I really didn't know where my life was supposed to go after that. I spent my whole life since I was 13 dreaming of going to the Olympics, being the first woman to win the Olympics up at 17. And then I accomplished it. And I'm like, what do I do now? And it was hard for me to go to sleep because I'm like, I feel like my life stops here. Like, what do I do now? Do I continue to box, or do I get pregnant and have kids? Do I go and get married? I'm like, what do I do? And I really had no idea. I graduated high school, and then I was like, well, let's go to college. That's what everybody does anyway, or everybody wanted me to do. So I went to college, and, you know, it was being back at home. I don't think I slept after the Olympics for at least 3 months. I was being pulled and pushed everywhere. You know, I had went to the state house in Lansing. I had got the key to the city. I was doing everything, and people were using my name who I didn't know and setting up events that I was supposed to be there, but I wasn't there. And it was happening so often, I'm like, my life is going way too fast. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. It seemed like the people around me didn't know what to do either. So that's what made it a little bit, you know, harder. But, you know, I still have my family, my friends, and my mama and my stepmom, Mickey, was, oh, my God. Me and her talked about everything. And sometimes when I was thinking about too much, she'd be like, just stay in the house today. Don't go nowhere. Lay down and go to sleep, and you'll start off fresh tomorrow. You're like, don't stress yourself out. Never put more on yourself than you can handle.
How would you like to see your career evolve from here? What do you have on the rest of your life list? What are you, 18 now?
19? I'm 20.
20, okay. So there's some more to go, you know.
You said 18. I wish. But right now, on the agenda is going to 2016 Olympics again. We have the Olympic trials in about 2 months, so I want to conquer that to win the 2016 Olympics, and after that, I want to go professional. And when I go professional, my only goal is to fight on TV. Fight on TV and of course, make some money, but also bring more attention and more respect to women's boxing. I want to go down in history as the best female fighter alive, yes, and whoever lives, you know, but I also want it to be easier for the women coming up behind me so it won't be so hard. Like, right now I don't have any endorsements. I have a sponsorship, and it's a great sponsorship. It's the Universal CUNY Foundation. But still with that, I want it to where women who are coming up, that the best athletes, the best women athletes are the ones that get the endorsements and get the sponsorships, because people have to realize that we train our whole life just like a man does, and we don't get to have a childhood. We have to lose weight and starve sometimes, and no other sport has to do that. No other sport has to watch their weight except for maybe wrestling, and I think wrestling and judo. I think it's more of combat sports, but no other sport like football, basketball, they can weigh whatever they want to weigh. When you can do a sport and you have to starve to do it, then you know you're really doing something.
Wow.
So those are my goals for when I, after the 2016 Olympics, is bring more attention to women's boxing, bring more respect, and just to show them that I feel like I'm better than the men boxing, the men who are boxing on, TV right now. So once I go pro, I want to showcase my skills and, hopefully America and all these other countries, click on to that. Women's boxing is here. Women's boxing is here to stay. And we're more entertaining than the men.
Well, Clarissa Shields, it is a huge honor to talk to you. I'm just so thrilled that you took the time to be on with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And T-Rex will air next spring on the PBS program Independent Lens, which is seen weekly on WKAR-TV. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. 70 years ago today, the first atomic weapon ever used in warfare was dropped on Hiroshima, Japan. That bomb, and the second one dropped 3 days later on Nagasaki, killed more than 200,000 people and forced an abrupt end to World War II. What happened to the crew that delivered the bomb to Tinian Island just days before is one of the most dramatic stories of the war. The tale of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis was famously recounted by actor Robert Shaw in the classic 1975 film, Jaws.
Japanese submarine slammed two torpedoes into her side, Chief. She was coming back from the island of Tinian to Lady and just delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. 1,100 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger, 13-footer, you know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail. Well, we didn't know. Was our bomb mission had been so secret, no distress signal had been sent.
Today, 31 survivors of the Indianapolis tragedy are still alive. Current State's Kevin Lavery just met one of them who lives in Lansing. In July 1945, Dick Thalen was an 18-year-old sailor on the Indianapolis. The ship had left Tinian Island bound for Leyte in the Philippines. There were nearly 1,200 men on board. Early in the morning of July 30th, Dick Thalen was trying to catch a nap before reporting on deck to stand his watch.
I was going to go on watch at 4 in the morning. I was up on the bow, sleeping in the bow, because a man had watched before me, and he was going to wake me up at 4:15 for the 4-8 watch in the morning. But I lay down about 10:15, and the ship was hit at 10 after, so I didn't sleep very long.
Do you recall what it sounded like, what it felt like?
Well, I was sleeping probably 8, 12 foot from the outer spine of the ship, And when I picked myself up, I had to hold a cable that goes outside the ship. I went in the air, and I don't know if I went 2 feet or 22 feet. I have no idea. But that's the way I woke up. I was going through the air. Anyhow, when I come down, I couldn't find my clothes or my shoes. So in other words, when I hit the water, I just had my shorts on. I lost everything.
And were you injured in that initial blast?
Well, I bumped a leg pretty bad. I got discharged from it. But other than that, I was lucky. I didn't draw no blood.
Events happened pretty quickly from that moment on. What was happening in those first few moments as you and your shipmates were starting to understand what was happening?
Well, so many times you were sleeping, thought you were real safe. Then all at once you was out in that ocean, dark, and you're floating around that diesel fuel, which is not pretty. And you know you was in trouble. As days went on, we kept talking to each other, thought we'd get picked up, you know, within a day or so it won't be too bad. But as the days went on, of course, we got hungrier and thirstier and kind of given up a little bit. But finally, we was rescued. It took a while.
You were floating in the South Pacific for something like 104 hours. Were you a strong swimmer before that?
I was a swimmer in junior high school team. Yeah, I was a good swimmer. And that helped me in the water. A friend of mine, he was in the water with me. I went through boot camp with him, and he had his shoes on. He was fully clothed. And I told him to take his shoes off because he can wear himself out kicking his shoe. He said, "Dick, I can't swim." Well, he died with his shoes on.
We're talking with Dick Thalen, who is one of 31 remaining survivors of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis at the very end of World War II. How did you keep your spirits up? That is, whenever you were conscious, I guess you were drifting in and out of consciousness for 4 days.
Well, to me, my opinion, and others are too, that it's easier to die out there than to try to stay alive, because you had to work at it to stay alive. You know what I'm saying? And everybody's got a breaking point in his mind. Some break earlier than others. Some last longer than others. I'm very lucky that everything was on the right way. My health was good, so that helped.
As you're watching your fellow sailors being eaten by sharks and exposure and dehydration, and was there a moment or two that you wanted to die? You did not want to survive?
Oh, yeah. Quite a few times I said, well, hell, we ain't going to make it. And I've seen some guys surface dive, take their jacket off, said they're going down below deck, get a drink of water. Well, down below deck, drink of water is cold water, of course. And if you do that and you gulp salt water on your stomach, you got about two or three hours to live. Foam comes to your mouth, your eyeballs pop out, and you'll go totally insane. In other words, they splash in the water, they go crazy. So in other words, their time is real limited. I say a few of them do that, so I didn't want to do that. I didn't do it. So every time I was ready to give up, there's my dad's face. He brought me home.
Today, as we're talking, Mr. Thalen, it's Sunday, August 2nd. It is 70 years to the day when you were rescued. And that rescue happened by accident.
That's right. Well, you want me to tell you how exactly on that rescue?
Please.
Okay, Chuck Gwynn, I got real close to him. He lives in California. He came to our Navy reunions. And he was asked to check a whirly, he called it a whirligig, to hook that whirligig to his trailing antenna because the antenna was going whipping into the tail section of the plane.
This was a Catalina PBY seaplane.
Yeah, and the whirligig fell off. And Chuck said, the whirligig didn't fall off, none of it survived because the whirligig fell off. So the radio man got a hold of Chuck to come aft to wind the antenna in. And that's when he seen the oil slick. Now, if that was malfunction of the antenna, he'd never seen us. So we were very, very lucky. There's a big ocean out there, and how big diameter that oil slick, I really can't tell you. But it wasn't very big compared to the ocean, you know what I'm saying? Just dropping a bucket. And Chuck said he came over top of the oil slick. He couldn't see anything, so he thought he'd get down a little lower. Well, he dropped lower X amount of feet, and that's when he seen survivors.
Completely by chance, then, a glint of light in the water.
He came over me after he seen us, and he had the bomb bay doors open, and I told him that. When he went over top of me, he just swayed his plane back and forth like that. So it was heaven on earth. You can't explain it. When they first picked up the survivors at the plane, they found out then where we were, who we were, what ship we come off of. Until Thursday afternoon, nobody knew nothing.
Now, this would be a compelling story anyway if it were not for the incredible mission that you were on to begin with. Your ship was delivering the components for the first atomic bomb.
Yeah, but the atomic bomb didn't have nothing to do with the sinking.
Right, exactly.
You know, there's no... And also, we already delivered it, so, you know, in other words, we was going to join the 7th Fleet for the invasion of Japan in Leyte. That's where we was headed.
And you saw the bomb components on board?
Oh, yeah. Well, they were in a big wooden box. I didn't see what it looked like, no.
We're talking with Dick Thalen, one of 31 remaining survivors from the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. That was the vessel that carried the components of the first atomic bomb to Tinian Island in the end of World War II, July of 1945. Then after this horrific incident, Mr. Thalen, came the court-martial of your commanding officer, Captain Charles McVeigh III, the only time in the history of the United States Navy that a commanding officer was court-martialed for losing a ship.
That's right. It's never happened before. They wonder why, but they did. That's why. Navy was trying to blame somebody for all the loss of life, and he couldn't do it. They got accused him, but he was exonerated later in life, or later in the world.
But it was too late, actually, because he committed suicide in the 60s.
In 68, and we didn't get exonerated until 1990. And we fought for 25, 30 years to get him exonerated.
Was the Navy's rationale to Captain McVeigh, look, what would have happened if you had been sunk while you still had the bomb on board?
The bomb was not put together, so it wouldn't be on, there wouldn't be no explosion or nothing. The Navy didn't want to take their blame for it. They wanted to pass the buck to somebody else. See, so that's the way it is. That's the way the Navy operates.
How long, Mr. Thalen, after the event, did you begin to settle into a normal psychological life? Does it still haunt you?
Oh, yeah. I didn't talk about it for years. My wife and I got married in 51. And the first book, Abandoned Ship, came out in 58. That's the first she knew I was on that ship. She didn't know the name of the ship, how long it was in the water, or nothing, because I didn't tell her. I just couldn't talk about it years ago.
Has it become the defining moment of your life, and are you okay with that if it has? I mean, obviously, this was 70 years ago, and you've had a very long, full life.
Oh, yeah. I told my whole family, if something happened to me today, heart attack, stroke, I'm gonna be whatever, I live my life. Don't ever shed a tear over my life, because I'm 88 years old, and you can't live forever. And I'm happy with my life. I had some serious operations a few years ago, and my second wife died here just last 4th July this year.
I'm sorry to hear that.
About a month ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago. She was, she had the ill health. Nice woman. We was married 9 years. So one of those things, part of life, you know. See, so you never know what, you know, what the future is gonna bring for you.
Sounds like all in all, though, you've come up pretty well.
Oh, yeah, I'm happy with my life and the family. Like I said, they're all healthy. There's no alcohol involved in the family, or no drugs. They don't, none of them spend any time in jail. So I've raised them, so they've done things right, or tried to anyhow. So, yeah, well, I'm pleased.
Dick Thalen is one of 31 remaining survivors of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis, the vessel that was carrying the components of the first atomic bomb to Tinian Island, and the sinking happened after the parts were delivered 70 years ago this week. Mr. Thalen, thank you for your incredible story and for your incredible service to our country. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Hope I did good.
You did great. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, you can catch Current State live at the Great Lakes Folk Festival. That will be at 6 p.m. We'll be in the Albert Street parking lot across from Hopcat. Our live music guests for the hour will be Dennis Stromat et l'Esprit Créole, one of the festival's featured performers. We'll also be talking to renowned Odawa quill worker Yvette Walker-Kieschik about how she turns porcupine quills and birch bark into incredible works of art. That and more tomorrow on Current State's live broadcast from the Great Lakes Folk Festival. Again, that's at 6 p.m. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, and Drew Hill. If you can't get to your radio, take the latest editions of Current State to go. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget, we're all over social media. We're at WKAR, at KAR Current State on Twitter, and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you could join us today. Have a great day. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. We'll